Well, I thought I would do this demo before this maple crashes, since it always seems to crash on me. I just want to demonstrate that Bessel functions are just as good as the complex, I mean not the exponential function, the real exponential, or sine and cosine. It's going to be given by a power series that's very explicit, and it's just as achievable. So let's see, I'm going to do, remember with in Maple, when you type with plots, you load a whole bunch of commands. And one command I want to use is animate. So that takes care of loading that stuff. I don't want to see that. So there's something called a Bessel function of order 0. And in Maple, it's called Bessel J, and that 0 is the order of the Bessel functions. It turns out that there's an order Bessel function for 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., including 0, that come up in various applications. But the Bessel function of order 0 is a famous one, and I'll plot it so you can see what it looks like. There it is. So that's the symmetric. So notice it's an even function, and notice it wiggles. So it's like sine and cosine. In fact, these Sturm-Liouville problems that the Bessel function solves, it's guaranteed that the solutions are going to wiggle, like sine and cosine. And that's kind of what makes Fourier series happen for Bessel functions. They're just like sines and cosines, and the wiggling is a key factor in the convergence of these series expansions in terms of Bessel functions. And it turns out the zeros of this Bessel function are going to be important to us. These zeros are calculated to great accuracy. Of course, nowadays with computers, it's no sweat. In the old days, there used to be tables of these zeros to computed out to high accuracy. So it wiggles, and it has zeros, and it's decaying. Those are all things to make note of here. And let's see. Oh, yeah, so I want to find some of those zeros. Let's see, let me look at that again. Let's see, there looks to be a zero if I magnify it. Here's five, and here's six. That zero between five and six is the second, there's the first zero, that's the second zero. And if I wanted to know that, course, I couldn't calculate it as an exact number because I don't think it's known what that exact number is. But I can F solve. That means solve in terms of floating point numerical. Don't solve it algebraically. If I put solve there, Maple would try to solve it as an algebraic thing and try to solve it exactly. But F solve does it numerically. And so I want to solve Bessel function equals 0, and I want the solution that's between 5 and 6. So that, if I didn't specify between 5 and 6, who knows which 0 I would get. It could be one that I have no interest in. Anyway, this will calculate. I'm setting A equal to that number. So it's like 5.52. If I wanted greater accuracy, I could set the digits parameter in Maple to something bigger. But I told you that Bessel functions are given by Taylor series. And here's the exact Taylor series for the Bessel function of order 0 out to 16th order. Notice how gigantic these bottom numbers are. They actually look like n factorial squared. So they're even, this thing converges even faster than the exponential function. So it's very quickly those terms become negligible, and you can chuck them out and treat your thing like a polynomial when it comes to doing numerical analysis. Let's see, and I wanted to, so I'm going to use Bessel functions to solve the vibrating circular membrane problem today. Here's one of the basic modes of oscillations. Oops. on my machine in my office, it computes this in a snap. Don't tell me it can't do it. That's odd. It's the hang up. Oh, blast. I figure I could kill. Sorry. Kill this. Maybe I'll try it again before we quit here today. What? Okay. No. Bah. Oh, that's annoying. Try it again or give up.
If it's just taking a long time to like render, you could just wait and switch to
the... Yeah, I'll switch to something else, but I this stupid thing has been crashing on me in various places. I don't know why. Alright, I gotta do it again. I gotta get that A. Alright, I'll try it again. Plot window one. Okay, we'll see what it does. I'll let you know if it pops up ever. Oops. Didn't I go to laptop? Sorry. Okay. So last time I solved by power series method the area equations. I thought maybe I'd do another example since there weren't so many people here on Friday, but I want to get this stuff done today before I do that. So I think I'll skip doing another example. A fun example to do would be power series solutions. You can do power series solutions to y double prime plus y equals zero. It's a good thing to sit through at least once. I did an Aries equation last time, which is y double prime minus xy equals zero. And that illustrates pretty much everything. But just so in case you weren't here on Friday, the power series method is you're going to try to solve this problem by assuming a power series solution. It's kind of like the method of undetermined coefficients where you assume you have a polynomial and you determine the coefficients by plugging it in and playing games in ODEs. But you try this thing. You don't know if it's going to work yet. You just try it. In that case, the derivative, let's see, the first order term is a constant, a naught. So the first derivative would start with 1 to infinity, and the derivative term by term is that. And you know that if a power series converges, you can differentiate it term by term. So the reason I knew that first term wasn't there is because this a naught term is a constant, and so its derivative is 0. And this one would start out with 1 times a1 plus 2a2x plus etc. And so the derivative of that first term is also 0 because it's constant. So this sum would start from the second n equal 2 spot. And the derivative is n times n minus 1 anx to the n minus 2. Now let's see, so that would start with 2 times 1 times a2 plus 3 times 2 times a3x plus dot dot dot. And now I'm going to plug that into the differential equation and try to make it work. So let's see, I plug into the ODE. So let's see, y double prime would be a sum as n goes from 2 to infinity, n times n minus 1 a n x to the n minus 2, so that's y double prime. Now plus y, that would be a sum as n goes from 0 to infinity, a n x to the n. And I want that to add up to 0. Now if these were polynomials, I'd collect coefficients, and I'd have a polynomial that's supposed to be the zero polynomial. The only way that could happen is if each one of the coefficients were zero. And that would give me equations to mess around with for the coefficients. So that, but the great thing about power series is they act a lot like polynomials because of Taylor's formula. If a Taylor series adds up to zero, Taylor's formula tells me that the nth coefficient has to be zero. So my next plan is to shove this under one sum. But the annoying thing is that this sum is x to the n, and this is x to the n minus 2. So remember, let's see, if you're here on Friday, I shifted indices and changed variables. Let's see, I made a curly n to be equal to n minus 2. And then I shifted all the indices to make this x to the power of this. Let's see, if curly n is n minus 2, then n square n is curly n plus 2. So I claim when I do this change of variables, this first one becomes, let's see, I'll figure out what the range of the sum is in a minute, but the square n then is curly n plus 2. The next number is 1 less than that, so it would be curly n plus 1. A sub, this number always matches this number, so it's going to be curly n plus 2. And I chose my change of variables so that this became the new n. Now let's see, so the powers here start from little n equals 2. So the first one is 2 minus 2, that's 0. So this thing, when I put this being the powers of x are going to start from 0 and go to infinity. Okay, I did this slower on Friday, but this is a quick review of how it works. And so this sum goes from curly n equals 0 to infinity. That sum is the same. If I wrote them out and just looked at them, I'd say, aha, yeah, that's exactly the same. But the good news here is that now I can jam these under I can jam these under one sum. And I can now change my n back to a square n. So after I do this shift, now change my curly n. It's just a dummy variable, so what the heck, back to an n. And then I can shove those two things under one sum, and they look nicer. So when I do that, I'd have a sum as n goes from 0 to infinity, n plus 2 times n plus 1, a n plus 2, and the whole thing is going to be times x to the n, and then the other one is plus a n. And I want that to be 0. Well, the only way that can be happen, it's like polynomials. This nth coefficient in front of x to the n has to be 0. Because remember, Taylor's formula tells you this here, a n is equal to the nth derivative of the function at 0 divided by n factorial. And this function is the 0 function. So that tells me this coefficient in front of x to n, if this is going to work, has to be 0. And so I set that equal to 0, and it gives me this thing called the recursion formula. So the recursion formula is an plus 2 equals minus an over n plus 2 times n plus 1. Pretty easy recursion formula. And let's see, this would be valid for n equals 0 and up. So all in other words. When I did the array function, it kicked in at n equal 1. There were some straggler terms to collect before this recursion formula kicked in. Here it kicks in right away. And so let's see, you'll notice there's not going to be any way to pin down a0 or a1. That's a feature, not a bug. Because, you know, when you're dealing with ODEs, you always have initial conditions. So note, y0, when you plug that in the power series, is a0. And the y' (0) over 1 factorial is a1. Those come from the initial conditions, so these won't be pinned down in any way. So you get these numbers from the initial conditions. They won't be pinned down, but now when I stick in n equals 0 in this equation, in the recursion formula, I get a2 is minus a0 over 2 times 1. And then n equal 1, I would get a3 equals minus a1 over 3 times 2. Very much, it kind of feels like the array functions, except this annoying minus sign is going to get in the way. At n equals 2, I get a4 equals minus a2 over 4 times 3. But I already have a2 from above here. There it is. And so I'll plug what I know about a2 in there, and I'll get a0 over 4 times 3 times 2 times 1. So let's see. I'm sticking this down in here. Actually, I'm sticking it in here. And this is, I'm not going to do too many more of these. You'll see the pattern. N equals 3 would give me a5 is minus a3 over 5 times 4. And I have a3 above. It's going to give me a1. I have two minus signs, so it'll become a plus, over 5 times 4 times 3 times 2. Okay, so, etc. ... forever. And you'll see the pattern real quick. And my solution that I get, let's see, my y is going to be a0 plus a1x plus a2x squared plus a3x cubed, etc. And now they're up above. I look at my numbers there. I keep doing these until I get down to a0 or a1, which I can always do. And it's going to alternate between the a0 and the a1. So you'll see when I pull out my a0 functions, I think I'll collect them like this. I'll have a bunch of things with an a0 in front. The first one was the one, the a0 term. The next one was minus 1 over 3 factorial x cubed. I'm sorry. No, it's squared. The next one was the a2 term. That was 1 over 2 times 1, which in other words 2 factorial, x squared. The next x to the fourth, there it is up there, it's a plus a0 over 4 factorial x to the fourth. And the next one will be minus 1 over 6 factorial x to the sixth, plus etc. And the A1 terms, let's see, the first one there is the A1x. And the next one is the one I just got. It's going to be 1 over 3 factorial x cubed. And let's see, the very last term was the fifth order one there, was 1 over 5 factorial x to the fifth minus etc. And then you spot, aha, that's the cosine function, that's the sine function. So this power series method found me y equals a naught cosine x plus a1 sine x. And those are valid solutions. They really do work. And the way you calculate sine and cosine is by power series. So they're not only do they work, but they're useful from the point of view of computations. I could show you now that the radius of convergence of these solutions are infinite. Because remember the ratio test when you're dealing with power series. I take a term out, far out, and divide by the term before it and look at the, see if that converges to a limit. Well, these terms, they alternate, you know, they jump by powers of 2 in these power series. So I'm not going to be dividing by 0 here. What I've got to do is think in terms of the actual terms. And so I like to write this as a term in the series that's far out near the end divided by the u that was right before it. And it's convenient if I'm thinking about a term way out there, that would be an a n plus 2 x to the n plus 2. And the term right before it is it's 2 powers less. X to the n. So that's a term that's way out there if n is big. And the term right before it is like that. And so we see that the reason I did this is because I want to use the recursion formula. Even though I guess I know what these numbers are. Sometimes I don't know what these numbers are. They could be some weird, crazy thing that I can't write down nicely. But I do know the ratio because the ratio comes from the recursion formula. And the recursion formula said an plus 2 was something times an. And so when I put the an on the other side, this becomes the absolute value of 1 over n plus 2 times n plus 1 x squared. Of course, that's x squared over n plus 2 times n plus 1. And as n goes to infinity, that goes to 0. And remember what the ratio test says. If that limit exists and is less than 1, the ratio test says that converges. So the ratio test tells me that those power series converge for all x, like you learned in freshman calculus. Sine and cosine have infinite radius of convergence. So the power series converges for all x. And so now, once you know that it converges for all x, all the stuff we did to find it are valid. So you can differentiate them term by term infinitely many times. You calculate the derivatives, you stick them in the equation. Because it satisfies the recursion formula, it solves the equation. So it means all those steps I did, you can do backwards and say, aha, these things solve the differential equations. So power series converge for all x, can differentiate as many times as you want. I can differentiate term by term. And we see they solve the ODE. Okay, they converge for all x, that's what we say r is equal to infinity in that case. The radius of convergence is infinite. So that method gives you sines and cosines and that's where sines and cosines actually come from. It's the kind of thing that Euler played around with. It's fun to do the exponential that way, too. I won't do it. But another example, it's even easier. You get the exponential, you can invent the exponential the way Euler did. You solve y prime equals y with initial conditions y of 0 equal 1. And use power series to do it. It just pops out the exponential in 5 minutes flat. Kind of fun to do at least once. Okay, now I want to show you where Bessel functions come from and why the feeling should be the same for Bessel functions. Nope, Maple's just not going to do it. That's a bummer. Huh. Okay, so what I want to do now here today is solve the vibrating circular membrane problem, or the drum head. Vibrating circular membrane. So we'll have a circular drum head. We'll make it have radius 1. And the wave equation for the vibrating drum head is d2u dt squared equal a constant squared. It's a positive constant, so we might as well call it c squared. C squared times the Laplacian of u. And I think I'll take c equal to 1 just to make my life easier. And let's see, since we have circular symmetry, it's very natural to use polar coordinates, in which case the Laplacian is d2u dr squared plus 1 over r du dr plus 1 over r squared dtu d theta squared. That is the Laplacian in polar coordinates. And let's see, if this drum is pinned down at the edge, like a good drum, so there's a boundary condition, namely that the drum doesn't move on the rim. So u, that radius 1, and any old theta in any old time has to be held constant. And then there's an initial condition, which comes, if I hit the drum, I'd give it some kind of initial displacement and initial velocity. So if I whacked it, that would push a little bump in it, and I'd have a ur theta at time 0, would be a known shape, fr of theta. And if I hit it hard, then I would also give it a velocity. So du dt would be known and would have some profile. So if this were like a little drum whack, I'd have this little bump, and then I'd also have a bump of velocity because I would have got that little chunk of the drum moving when I whack it with a stick. Or I could pluck the drum, and I could poke my finger in it and let go real fast, and it would start vibrating. Then I could make the G be zero if I poked it and let go real fast, and it would vibrate like a harpsichord string. But that's the basic problem. So it's a partial differential equation with a boundary condition and initial conditions, just like the vibrating string problem. Let's see. So when I plug, so if I want to use separation of variables, which is the classic technique, it's a hard problem just to do. Can't use a Fourier transform in this kind of a problem, but Fourier series are going to be relevant. This method of separation of variables is to try a function of r, theta, and t that can be pulled apart to be a function of r times a function of theta times a function of time. That's my capital theta there with that thing with the h in the middle. And when I plug it into the partial differential equation, so I plug into the PDE, let's see, du dt would be r theta t prime when I differentiate with respect to time. Because the only function in my trio there that has a t in it is the t function. And then the Laplacian, let's see, I take a derivative with respect to r squared. So that would give me an r double prime theta t. That's du dr squared, the first term in the polar Laplacian. The next term is 1 over little r du dr. That would be one derivative on the r function. The others would sit along like a constant. And then finally, a 1 over r squared times r theta double prime t. So that's 1 over r squared d by d theta 2 times.
Should be a t double prime.
T double prime, right? This is not the heat equation, this is the wave equation. By the way, if I was solving the heat equation, this would be a hot plate. And there'd be just one derivative there in the heat equation. And so that, here's the interesting thing. If the heat, the time problem is going to be T double prime over T equal a constant. That's always wiggling sines and cosines. If it's the heat problem, it's T prime over T equals a constant. And you get negative exponentials that way. And that's why the heat problems always die away so fast, because you get negative exponentials with T prime over T equal a negative constant. So that's why the heat equation is so different than the wave equation. The wave equation, you get wiggling in time. The heat problem, it just, the heat kind of gets sucked out and diffuses away like a negative exponential. That's why they're way different. This is the moment when I'm going to take C to be 1. So no more C from now on. If you stare at that for a minute, you kind of feel like I could pull it apart by dividing by r theta t. Because every term has just exactly one derivative in it. So if I divide by r times theta times t, capital theta, that's a capital theta this time. Then I would get t double prime over t equals r double prime over r plus 1 over r prime over r. And here's an annoying term. 1 over r squared theta double prime over theta. Well, here's a function of time trying to be equal to a function of r and theta. The only way you can make that happen is if this are both equal to a constant, the same constant. So let's call these equal to lambda. Okay, so my t problem isn't going to have any other conditions on it, so I'm going to leave my lambda alone for now. But this problem now isn't so easy to mess with. I can't pull it apart. This r squared here is an annoying pain. And so today I'm going to solve the problem. I'm going to assume that my solution doesn't depend on theta today. So for today, assume u does not depend on theta. I'm looking for radial solutions. So they're radially symmetric solutions. There are plenty. Radially symmetric solutions. then that would make theta double prime over theta equal to 0. And so my problem is, my R problem, let's see, I'm going to want u of 1 theta t to be, that would be r of 1 theta of theta times t of t. I want that to be identically 0. And I don't want to get 0 solutions. So the only way that I can have that happen without getting the 0 solutions is I need this r of 1 to be equal to 0.
When you say for the t, it's not going to depend on theta. Is there a situation where it would?
Yes. If you stick your coffee cup on the microwave, you'll see that there's definitely, there's bumps in the theta direction. If you sit just right on the microwave, you might get the one where just the middle goes up and down.
Okay.
So yeah, there's infinitely many solutions, and it's kind of cool to see the different modes of oscillations. The ones that don't depend on theta look like, if you ever seen a drop in the water, and you get this big bump, and then little ripples go out. It looks like a Bessel function. It is a Bessel function. The ripples that when you drop in the water are exactly going out like Bessel functions. Let's see. Yeah, so there's the boundary condition. Funny, when we've done any other problem, we had two boundary conditions. This is only one. So what the heck is the other boundary condition? There isn't one. And we always needed two. So the question is, where is that other boundary condition going to come in? It turns out that we need bounded solutions. So the zero is going to be a relevant spot to look at. And it's going to be like having the other boundary condition. To keep it bounded, we're going to be able to eliminate a bunch of solutions that would rip the drum up if they were allowed. Okay, so we have this boundary condition. But the differential equation problem is r squared over r plus 1 over r prime over r equals a lambda. Okay, so there's going to be cases. Let's do case lambda equals 0. If lambda is equal to 0, then this equation is r double prime, over r. It would be an r squared, I'm going to multiply through by r squared, plus r prime equals, do I have to do this? Let me be more careful about this. Let's see, so this would be r double prime plus 1 over r prime minus lambda r equals 0. To make this look like a standard differential equation, I'm going to multiply through by r, or the lambda is equal to 0. So that's not there. To make it look like a standard differential equation, I'll make it r squared r double prime. So I multiplied through by r. That's an Euler equation. They come up exactly here. And you solve them in the homework with Stein. So remember, they look like this. An Euler equation looks like A r squared r double prime plus B r prime plus C r equals 0. And you try a solution that looks like r to a power. And you plug it into the differential equation, and you get a characteristic polynomial in P. You get, when you plug it in, you get A times P minus 1 plus B times P plus C equals 0. And when you're lucky, you get two solutions that way. This is a quadratic equation in P. It has two roots. And so if you're lucky, you get two solutions. They're linearly independent. You've got the general solution. You're done. So that's Euler's equation. And you solved it in the homework with Stein one day, way back. He gave you enough hints that you could just do it. He solved it without doing this trick, by the way. He found a direct integral of the problem, which was nice. Okay, so our problem is the A is equal to 1, and the B is equal to 1, and the C is equal to 0. So we have, for us, A equals 1, B equals 1, C equals 0. And guess what we get here? We get P times P minus 1 plus P equals 0. P squared equals 0. And so that's, I wouldn't say ouch, that's actually going to be good. We get P equals the double root, 0 and 0. Well, this is one of those cases in ODEs where you want two solutions, but you only get one. Okay, so you get one perfectly good solution. Get one solution. R of R equals R to the 0th, which is 1. And sure enough, 1 does solve that problem. Well, now you can do something called reduction of order to get a second solution. Reduction of order. To get a second solution. So I'll briefly tell you what the method of reduction of order is. So you would try your second solution. Let's call this R1 of R. You get R2 of R equals an unknown function of R times the function, the solution you found. This thing solves the equation. And you plug it into the differential equation, and you'll get a first order ODE for R. So you plug into the ODE. It's pretty easy to do here. Plug into the ODE. Get a first order simple ODE for U that you can always solve. You solve it and you get a second linearly independent solution. So for example, in this case, let's just do it. I'll do it. My second solution is going to be U times 1. And when I plug that into the differential equation, my differential equation was R squared, second derivative of that, plus R times the first derivative of that. Oops, what am I doing? R times the second derivative of that would be U double prime, plus R times the first derivative of that would be R times U prime, and that equals 0. That's a first order linear equation in U prime. So let's see, that would be equal to dv dr plus 1 over r v equals 0, where v equals u prime. Well, that's a very simple ODE. That means if I multiply through by r, I'd get r dv dr plus v equals 0. That's just the derivative d by dr of r times v. And so r times v is a constant. And therefore v is constant over r. And remember, v is equal to u prime. And so u, so finally, u is equal to c log r. And my second solution is r2 is equal to u times r1. That's c times log r times 1. And this is like the missing other boundary condition. My solution has to be bounded. Otherwise, this is going to rip the drum up and have a big hole in the middle. So, this is, ouch, that's a drum ripper. So, my solution, my general solution to this problem that I just found is R of R equals C1 times 1 plus C2. I'll absorb that C. This constant can be anything, so I'll call it C2 times log R. For my solution to be bounded, the C2 must be 0. So C2 must equal 0. To be bounded. And now to make my other boundary condition, I need R of 1 to be 1, and no 0. So I need R of 1 equals C1 times 1 equals 0. I want that. And so C1 has to be 0 too. So this is one of those annoying cases where I only get the 0 solution. So I only get the 0 solution. And so I get nothing. And now the next case is going to be the case that's interesting. And I'm out of time today, so I won't be able to do this. I'll do it next time. So I'll just tell you that the next case, this is not an interesting one. Case lambda, positive. It's possible to show there are no non-zero bounded solutions. I'll skip that part. We can show there are no non-zero bounded solutions. So the last case to deal with is going to be the case lambda negative, and that's going to give us Bessel functions. And they're going to be just as good as exponentials and sines and cosines, and I'll deal with them next time. Okay, that's enough for today. Yes, I put it up, I'll send an email. I just put it on Blackboard. I also put it on the homepage.
Okay, so
you can get it. I'll send an email. I meant to talk about that. I guess when Maple crashed, I lost my...